I do see some familiar faces, which means that I remember you from last time. And I'm not sure why you're back. Do you really think that I withheld some information from you last time? I wouldn't be so inconsiderate as that. And if I told you all that I knew then, well, I guess it's a compliment if you think that I've learned something in the past year. But at any rate, glad to be with you. I always think it's a great event when people get together. And I'm not even sure that it makes much difference why we get together. It is so important that at a time, you know, we're talking about fragmentation. When there is so much unfortunate fragmentation among various peoples and among ourselves, that anything that brings us together is important. And even if what I have to say tonight is what you've already heard, or for any other reason would not have much value, the fact that a group of people get together under the same roof has value. I sometimes say that, there is unfortunately a practice that when people come together in shul that they begin conversation, which is of course completely unacceptable, and there's many strong rabbinical condemnations of this. And yet, you know, we have to find some merit in everything and find some redeeming feature in everything we do. The great Rebbe of Baidichev used to find a redeeming feature in everyone. The story with, he once came across a man standing with his talus and film and greasing the wheels of his wagon so that he could ride smoother after davening. And of course, everybody thought this was a sacrilege, and the Rebbe Yitzchak Baidichev said, look, Almighty God, even when he greases the wheels, he still nevertheless thinks about you and puts on his talus and tefillin. So we have to look at everything in some sort of positive sense. And I once thought about, why is it necessary to have a minyan? Isn't it possible that God would hear our prayers even if we davened alone? And I began to think that perhaps the reason for it was that God wanted us to be in greater communication with each other. So that if we get together, we'll say, Yanko, what's doing by you? And how's the family? And how's this? And how's that? And so we make some exchange and get to know what's doing with each other, and it brings us closer to one another. I said, that's why we have to have a shul, and that's why we have to have a minyan. So people could exchange ideas and find out a little bit about what's doing with each other. That's the real purpose of the shul. Now, if you want to daven, go out in the hall, but I only say that as a last-ditch redeeming feature, but really we should not be talking during davening. But again, let me just stress that it makes me feel worthwhile that if for whatever reason I've been able to bring people together, whether you talk to each other here while waiting for the program to start or you'll exchange information on your way out, that's great. We need to be together because we are far too often fragmented. But having said that, I think that the title that was given tonight was Living a Whole Life in a Fragmented World. Now, if you saw the flyer that I saw, there was a picture of a globe, the world fragmented, and Snoopy sitting on top. Now, I have a great deal of respect for Snoopy, but even he could not put this fragmented world together. So we're going to have to find some other method to do it. And I'm not sure that I have solutions, but so often the solution may be found by each of us if only we ask the right questions and become aware of the problem. And as you know, as a psychiatrist, I don't have much more wisdom than anyone else. And yet, we can be of help to people because when they come in, they begin to describe their problems in greater detail. And you have no idea how often when a person begins to describe his or her problems and try to clarify it for someone else, they become clearer for themselves and they find their own solutions. And many times I have said to people when they call about, can we come in for a consultation? I said, please don't make the trip from New York. It's an expensive, prohibitive trip for an hour consultation. Please write me the problem. And you have no idea how often in the process of writing out the problem, putting in pencil and paper, we find our solutions. So if we'll talk a little bit about fragmentation, I don't have solutions, but maybe if we discuss the problem together, we may find some. In what way are we fragmented? Well, we're probably fragmented in any number of ways. Very clearly, the options that a person has today are much greater than the options that we had before. There are so many different things that we can do, so many different sources of information, so much more time that we have to be able to involve ourselves in different things that we do become fragmented. And whereas previously we had access to book information, we now have access to CD-ROMs and internet, and it is true, it is actually awesome when you sit in front of the internet and you see how much information is at your fingertips. I tried to do a little search on an article last week, and it turned out that there were 25,000 titles under that topic. These are astronomical numbers, and that's in only one area, and heaven knows how much there is in many other areas, the whole world of information at your fingertips. And you say, is that good? Well, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. There is such a thing as information overload. You know that one of the most difficult illnesses that we have to treat in psychiatry is schizophrenia. To this day, we're not sure what causes it. But one of the theories is, it's an interesting theory, is that in good health, we have a filter system that filters how much information comes into our mind. Because if we were really aware of everything that impinges on us at any moment, we would be dysfunctional or non-functional. I mean, just for a moment, okay? Think about the fact, if you can feel your right elbow, that your right elbow is probably resting on something, and that there is a sensation, a point of sensation. If you'll think about it for a moment, you'll feel. Now, until I mentioned that to you, you weren't aware of it. But if I call your attention to it, you realize you have that sensation. And in fact, if you think a little closer, if you're wearing your wristwatch and think about where the wristwatch is, you'll become aware in a moment of concentration that, yes, you can feel where the band is around your wrist. But again, until I call it to your attention, you don't think of it. I'm just citing those as two points, and there's probably hundreds of different things that are going on at any one moment in your environment that you could be aware of, but if you were aware of everything that happens, there'd be no way that you could process all that information at once. There would be a breakdown of the system. So we have a normal filtering system that keeps all extraneous information out and allows us to focus on whatever it is that we're doing, one or two or three items in our environment. You see, when life was much simpler and we did not have internet and we did not have many other options, we did not become fragmented. But today it is so much more difficult to focus on one situation when there's so many different ways to go. A number of years ago, I took over the position as director of psychiatry at St. Francis General Hospital, which, as the term indicates, is a Catholic institution. And this was in 1965, was shortly after some of the rather momentous changes in the church structure in Vatican II. And I received a call from the bishop at that time, later cardinal, whether I might be able to put together a group of a staff that would be able to help deal with some of the turmoil that is going on within the convents. And there was some considerable difficulty in adjusting to some of the new situations. Now, I remember distinctly one young woman who came in and was very upset and showed me that she had received a questionnaire as to what she wanted to do during the next year. Prior to that, a nun was either a teacher or a nurse, or somehow worked in the convent. And now there were a number of options that she had never had before, as a result of the restrictions removed by Vatican II. And she was very upset with this, because she said that one of the reasons that she had come into this structure was to have the comfort of having one or two choices and not having to look at 15 different options. And essentially what she was saying, if I'm going to have all these choices, why am I here? So you see, having a number of choices may seem, well, you know, the greater the menu is, the more we can enjoy ourselves, the more that we can choose from. And I'm not at all sure that that's always true. I sometimes can sit in a restaurant and look at a menu and be totally paralyzed by not knowing what to order. And if they had simply, if I had come in, they told me tonight we're serving roast chicken and that's it, I would have been perfectly satisfied. So, yes, I think that the enormous amount of information that's available, the enormous number of options that we have, especially young people, has caused a kind of fragmentation in the sense that we're being pulled in 11 different directions. Job-wise, informational-wise, marriage-wise, and every other way. There's another fragmentation that may even be a little more subtle, but also a little more difficult. And that is the fragmentation of our own identity as to who am I really. And one of the things that has happened in our industry, we call it codependency, is that too often we let our identity be decided by other people as to what they expect of us. And if I don't have an identity of my own, then I have to become what other people want me to be. And the danger of that is that instead of being one person, I am five or six or seven people, turning like a chameleon as to whatever people expect of me. A very difficult status to maintain and still remain in optimum emotional and functional health. A while back I wrote a book entitled I Am I, where I quoted the famous tongue twister statement by the great Hasidic master of Kutsk, Rabbi Mendel of Kutsk, who said, if I am I because I am I, and you are you because you are you, then I am an I and you are a you. But if I am I because you are you, and you are you because I am I, then I am not an I and you are not a you. A little bit of a tongue twister, but it is putting it very, very beautifully. I have to be myself. And if I don't have a real sense of self, and I only become what people expect of me, then I may be one thing to my spouse, and another thing to my boss, and another thing to this friend, and another thing to this friend, to different members of the community, and I have to change identities so often because I have no identity. So it's all right to have one or two identities. As Clark Kent has taught us, you know, you switch and become Superman. But in real life, to have a multiplicity of identities, this is not the multiple personality that psychiatry talks about. But it is a very common condition and a very uncomfortable one. I always like to tell the story, and if you've heard it last time, I'll just tell it again because I think it's so beautiful, about how meaningless an identity is if it's given to us by someone else. And sometimes in desperation, if we don't have an identity, we will look for one and not develop our own. And the story is one of my favorite stories of Chelm. Now, you all read these stories of the wise men of Chelm. They are supposed to have been rather foolish people, but they are foolish in a very kind, in a very unique and clever way. And the story goes that one time, one of the Chelmites was in the public bathhouse, and he noticed that with everybody being unclothed, that everybody looked pretty much alike. And then he had this terrible confusion, because what's going to happen when it comes time to go home? How will I know which one is me? And he thought about it a little, and he came to a conclusion that only a Chelmite could. Found a piece of red string, and he tied it around his toe. And now he had a distinctive, you know, identity as to who he was. The problem was that as he continued bathing and sudsing and showering and lathering and whatever, the string fell off. But what was infinitely worse was that another bather stepped on it and then adhered to his toe. And so when it came time to go home, and he took a look at his foot, and there was nothing there. And then he looked at this other man, and he saw that this guy had a string on his toe. So he went over and he tapped him, and he said, "Pardon me, sir." He said, "I know who you are, but can you tell me who am I?" It's such a precious little story as to what happens if you don't have an identity of your own and you have to get one from somewhere. Now, I have seen some people whose claim to an identity is, "I am the one with the luxury car in the driveway." Right? Or, "I am the one who has the marble staircase," or some such luxury. And the thing that bothers me, if that's the person's identity, well, what happens when he sells the car? Does that other person become him? I've sometimes seen people go into different fields of life hoping that that would give them an identity. Now, there's all kinds of reasons to choose a business or a profession. But sometimes a person, let's take medicine for an example. If a person feels impoverished in any other way, he may feel that the MD after his name gives him an identity. But of course, if my only identity is as an MD or CPA or whatever, then I really don't have an identity of my own. There's perhaps a million doctors, and I'm just one of a million, and I am not a unique individual. And maybe it's my ego, but I have a fierce idea of being unique. I like the idea that my fingerprints are unique. I like the idea that they're telling me now that my blood type is unique. I like the idea that the Talmud says that not only are their facial features unique, and unless we're identical twins, we don't look alike, but if our facial features are unique, think about how unique our personalities must be. And I like this idea of uniqueness. In fact, it even bothers me that some of our mass production techniques in education and in socializing have taken so much of our uniqueness away. Now, I grew up in a generation when I was a child the older generation, many of them were original immigrants to the United States, first generation immigrants. These people were fiercely unique. No two of them were alike. And today, with people being mass-produced, educated, pushed through educational institutions and molded into one character, and whatever the institution has left undone, the mass media takes care of. And so instead of thinking for ourselves, the television commentators and other sources think for us and mold our ideas. And I miss the old uniqueness. These were wonderful, wonderful people. No two of them were alike. And if I wasn't committed to covering the topic tonight, I'd just throw the whole thing overboard and tell you stories about the old timers that I remember from age 5 and 6 and 7. They were really fascinating, fascinating characters. And I miss them. So, I am far too avid a advocate of uniqueness to allow myself to have an identity which so many other people can share with me. Very well then, so we should have an identity of our own. But how do we go about getting this identity of our own? And of course this will fit right into the theme that I've said, you know, when Rabbi Edelstein talked before about my having written one book, and I've said it many times. I have not written 23 books. I have written one book in 23 different ways. And the theme that I always come back to, no matter where you'll get me started, I'll always come back to the same thing. And that is that our prime problem in adjusting to life is a lack of proper self-awareness, which would, if we had, would give us a sense of self-worth, self-confidence, self-esteem, which could help us make a much more satisfactory adjustment to life. There's hardly any malady that affects us behaviorally, hardly any malady that cannot be traced back to a problem of feelings of inadequacy and low self-esteem that we have no business having. And you see, if I don't have feelings of adequacy, then I am vulnerable to letting other people do my thinking for me. And this is so beautifully illustrated in Mr. Schultz's cartoons, where Charlie Brown says very emphatically, "And yes, that's what I think, and that's the way it is." And Linus says to him, "Charlie Brown, I think you have your facts mixed up." And Charlie Brown says, "You really think so?" He says, "You know, I have strong opinions, it's just that they don't last very long." And you know, if you don't have a sense of self-worth, which is of course what Charlie Brown lacks, then you let other people make decisions for you. And there will be other people who make decisions for you, like Lucy. She's ready to make decisions for everybody. Right? So we need to have a feeling of self-worth. How do we go about getting it? First of all, I think we have to have a philosophy of this wholeness that we're talking about. The wholeness, of course, beginning with the one unit, body and spirit. Or as we would say in Hebrew, guf and neshama, the body and the soul. And it would help also if we could become unidirectional, going in one direction instead of being pulled apart in 11. And then let me ask you, think a little bit about this. Don't give me an answer now, but think about this as you leave. Does anybody have one direction in life? What is it that I want with my life? Now, one of the problems is that Western culture has given an answer to that. The direction of life that Western culture has is get as much pleasure and fun as you can out of it. And if you don't believe that, watch your television. Most of the advertisements on the television are to tell you either how to get rid of distress or how to have pleasure. Maximize the fun you can get. Now, I'm not a killjoy. Yeah? I said, please, have fun, enjoy the world. The world was given to be enjoyed. We are told that one of the questions that we will be asked on Judgment Day when we come up before the heavenly tribunal is that God will ask us, did you enjoy my world? So yes, it is here to be enjoyed. And yet, having said that, pleasure should not be the single or primary goal in life. And when we find a primary goal in life and direct ourselves toward it, then by all means, while you're en route to that primary goal, you may enjoy life to the fullest. But don't make pleasure the primary goal in life. You say, why not? Well, I said, for two reasons, or maybe three, or maybe six. But first of all, if contentment was the goal in life that we were supposed to have, I have no reason why we were given this enormous brain, because it is so much easier to be content being a cow. You drive by the farms, right, and the cows in the pastures are far more content than those of us sitting behind even a luxury automobile, right, and listening to the radio and hearing all the sorrows that are going on in all parts of the world. The cow is much better off. And if content was the goal in life, then the brain is a terrible mistake. And just by virtue of the fact that we have this brain that can produce a Beethoven's Ninth Symphony or the works of Shakespeare or all the other great arts of the world, should be an indication that we were intended for something else over and above mere pleasure. But it goes beyond that. A number of years ago, that time, Nancy Reagan was the first lady. And, of course, there's been concern in the past 20 years or so what we do about the drug epidemic, especially among young people. And so she suggested a program, a campaign of just say no to drugs. And so you've seen the billboards and the bumper stickers and the lapel pins, just say no to drugs. And a few researchers at that time made a study where they asked of young people what they thought of the campaign, what they thought of just say no to drugs. And they reported that a significant number of 13 and 14 and 15 year olds responded with, why? And a very simple question. What else is there? Now, you've got to remember that when they ask the question why, that you cannot, in terms of practical, you cannot tell young people that they should not use drugs because drugs are terribly dangerous. Because that has no impact whatever. I've been working in the field for 26 years, and that has no impact whatever. Youngsters feel immune to danger. So the scare techniques will not work. And the idea of parading celebrities before them, that too has backfired. In fact, it's unfortunate that after all the millions and billions of dollars that has been spent on prevention programs, we still cannot point to any single program and say this is the answer. And then my contention is that we're not going to have an answer to it unless we can answer the question that kids are asking, or at least thinking of. Why? What else is there? And as long as the adult world, don't forget, kids may or may not do as you do. They certainly will not do as you say. And if we're going to try and impact our youngsters, we're going to have to impact them as models. And if the adult world is completely committed to a goal in life of get the maximum fun and pleasure that you can out of it, then our youngsters are going to follow suit. And in this age, when there is so little tolerance for delay, when the fax machines give us instant communications and email gives us even quicker communications, and that we have jet flights and, you have no idea how annoyed I was this morning that it took me 4 hours and 15 minutes to get here all the way from Pittsburgh. My idea was it should have been there in about an hour. This is the kind of intolerance that we've developed toward delay. And so we have our microwaves and our other technological miracles that have given us many comforts and many conveniences, but it's also taken away our tolerance for any kind of delay whatsoever. And this is the world that our youngsters have grown up in, where the word wait is meaningless, eventually has lost its meaning, even in terms of minutes or hours, let alone 20 years. And so when kids are looking for a kick in life, because this is what everybody else is looking for, they want it now. And there are ways of getting it now. And so they indulge in promiscuous sex, and they use the various drugs that give them an immediate thrill. And so when they ask a question, why, what else is there, we have to be able to come up with a reasonable answer, not one which is logical to us, but one which is going to make sense to the young people. And so far we've struck out. And so if you've seen during the campaign of recent elections, the alarming figure that in the last 6 years there's been 170% increase of use of drugs among young people, you see how alarming that is, that no, we no longer have to worry about being obliterated by a nuclear bomb, but we do have to worry about being obliterated by a drug epidemic among our youth. And I must tell you that was one of the painful things that I discovered a few years ago, becoming involved in the drug treatment program in Israel, that the increase in drug use among adolescents in Israel is greater than it is in the United States. And we have hostile enemies that we have to deal with. And again, we have to really be concerned that even if we reach terms with our hostile neighbors and have a cessation of hostilities, that the prime threat to the survival of Israel may be the erosion of its youth by the drug epidemic. So we need to somehow have a question, what else is there? An answer to the question. And the only answer to the question can be if we model ourselves that there is something else that we are looking forward to in life other than self-gratification, in whichever way it comes. And please, I did not say, don't walk away from here saying, he says that you can't enjoy life. I enjoy life in whatever way I can. But the goal in life cannot be mere pleasure. And so we have to find a direction. And this is why I have to challenge myself and why I feel all of us have to challenge ourselves. What is my direction in life? What do I want to accomplish with these 120 years? May you all be blessed with long life, with these 120 years on earth. And rather than being fragmented and saying I want to accomplish this and this and that and that and that, I think we have to become unidirectional. And so I think we have to figure it out for ourselves. Am I advocating that everybody should adapt the religious aspect to life? I see nothing wrong with it. It certainly can provide direction. And I think that there is a theme that goes through Judaism, the theme of Echad, of oneness. Certainly when we proclaim our faith, we do so with the very famous, well-known Shema Yisrael. Hashem Echad, that God is one. And then there's a beautiful statement from the Zohar that God and the Torah and Israel are one. That we are not anything separate from the Torah, we are not anything separate from God. We are all one and the same. And then we have another phrase where it refers to Israel as being Goy Echot, a nation of oneness. Not only that we should be joining arms and becoming more unified with each other, as I began by this evening by saying, but also that we should be able to feel each and every one of us that we are a unit, that we are a one, not a fragmented entity. Now, sometimes I wonder, were we given any guidelines for this? And at times I have different ideas as to what our sages were directing us. And I begin thinking about how do we begin our day? And we are to begin our day with opening our eyes in the morning and reciting a very simple prayer. Moda ani lefonecha. Let's just focus on the first two words. Moda ani. I am thankful. Two simple words. I am thankful. And of course, if we dwell on those, then we can come up with another theme. First of all, we're going to have to identify who is the I, without any red strings on our toes. And then we'll have to think about gratitude. And gratitude for what? Gratitude that I am alive. How many people have said, I didn't ask to be born, what do you want from me? And the concept of gratitude to be alive is an important philosophical concept. That we do have a mission in life and we were created to fulfill that mission, and it is for our own good that we are alive. And yes, it is better than we exist, that existence is a positive. And all of those things, you know, have a marked effect on our behavior if only we realize what it means to say Moda Ami. There is an I, and that I is grateful. But I want to tell you that the idea of gratitude itself is an important one. You know, there's a lot of people have difficulty in being grateful. If you have any doubt about that, watch a little kid. How many times have you seen or experienced it where the child receives something, perhaps somebody's given him candy, and he gleefully takes it, and then you tell the child, say thank you to the man for the candy. Now please, now say thank you to the man. You practically have to kill the child to get the word thank you out of him. What's the problem? And I think one of the problems is that, you know, that sometimes there is a resistance to recognizing and acknowledging gratitude, recognizing that someone has done me a kindness. And perhaps the reason for that is because if I recognize that someone has done me a kindness, then I may have to be beholden to that person, and I may have to be obligated. I don't like to feel beholden to anybody. I don't like to feel obligated. And so to protect myself from that unpleasant feeling of being obligated or being beholden, I just denied that you ever did me a favor. My grandfather was a very wise person, was a very prominent Hasidic Rebbe, and he once was musing. He said, now I know why he doesn't like me, and I know why he doesn't like me, but him, I never did him a favor. What he was saying, you know, sometimes, paradoxically, you think that if you do someone a favor that he will like you for it, let me tell you, practically that's not so. Practically, you probably have greater love for people for whom you do something, right, than if they have done something for you. Now, one of the reasons that focus is, as I told you, everything is going to be back to the, bring you back to the problem of self-esteem. A person with self-esteem doesn't have any problem in accepting kindnesses. It's not a put-down to me if you do something for me. On the other hand, if I'm walking around with feelings of inadequacy, then I have to prove my self-sufficiency. You can't go around doing things for me because that shows me that I'm weak. So I must insist on independence. I must insist on doing things for myself, and therefore I can't acknowledge that you did anything for me, and I have to repress it, blot it out from my awareness, and no, I cannot say thank you. Incidentally, I know I digress a good bit, but there may be good reason for this. Sometimes I think that if we only really learned the kinds of things from davening, from prayer, that we should, our lives would be totally different. There are three things that occur in prayer again and again and again. One is the expression of gratitude to God. The second is the confession of our sins. And the third is the statement of Ve'ahavtos Hashem Elokecha, that we love God. Three simple phrases. I thank you. I did wrong. I love you. Now, you know, if only we learned those phrases and repeated them more often. I thank you. I love you. I'm sorry, I was wrong. How many severed relationships would have remained intact? How many marriages that have failed would have remained intact if the two people had said those three magic words, three magic phrases to each other more often? And sometimes I think we lose the point of what davening is all about. Hopefully, if we say it three times a day, if we say it to God, at least the words will not be alien to us, and we'll be able to say it to one another. But getting back to the theme, again, of gratitude. In order to be grateful, you have to think well enough of yourself that you can accept someone else's kindness, and yes, even God's kindness. So when you begin the day by saying, Moda, grateful, and then you can say, Ani, there is an I that is grateful. I am me. And I am grateful that you have given me a life because I have something to do with it. Now, do you really think that God would have created us to come back home after a day's work only to sit in front of the television set and watch the idiot tube and open a can of beer and kick off our slippers? Is it conceivable that that is the purpose of existence? No, I'm not saying that you can't enjoy a good television program, although I'm not sure that those exist. Somehow I think that when Lucy went off the air, it all was off. No, but I do think that there is some rationale in having some entertainment. I shall confess to you that, yes, I do watch football. But, of course, it has to fit into my schedule because I do have a schedule of how much time I need for relaxation. And I recognize, working with addiction, about how easy it is to lose control and to rationalize, just like the alcoholic or the addict does. I need just a little bit more, just for today, just for now, just whatever. And so I've taken precautions that that should not happen. And at one time I was doing some writing and was quite exhausted and felt that I really needed about 15 minutes for watching a football game. So I went down to the television, put the timer on the stove on to ring in 15 minutes. And I watched the Steelers play for 15 minutes. The trying thing was that when the timer rang, the score was 17-17. And I had to tear myself away because I had made it a principle that I am not going to extend it by any 1 minute or 2 minutes or 3 minutes. So I turned the TV off. I had had my 15 minutes of entertainment. And I found out later, just as I would have then, that we won 20-17, for which I was very happy. But again, yes, it is legitimate to have some entertainment, and it's legitimate to have rest, and legitimate to have relaxation. But it should fit into the framework of what do I want to do with my life? Now, let's assume, for example, now you may have other goals in life. With that, I'm not saying you've got to adopt a goal in life just because I have. But what I'm saying is it has to be something other than my own gratification, something external to myself. If you want your goal to be preventing famine in Ethiopia, that's fine. I'm not talking as a rabbi, I'm talking as a psychologist. As a rabbi, of course, I'll have to tell you what the goal of life is that we teach and preach as rabbis. And in that respect, the goal of life is that God put us here for a purpose, and I better find out what that purpose is and dedicate my life to that purpose. And that then becomes my direction. And then everything fits into that one direction, and I'm not fragmented in 15 different ways. Because anything that I do, I have to see, how does that fit into the scheme of things? Now, of course, we are always capable of deceiving ourselves. And I'm not sure that I was not deceiving myself, I hope I was not, by saying, this 15 minutes of entertainment I need for my emotional well-being. I need 6 hours or 6.5 hours of sleep for my physical well-being. I need a nutritious diet for my well-being. I need exercise for my well-being. All of these are for my well-being so that I will be in optimum condition to be able to perform my function on earth. And then if you come with something else for me to do or something else tempts me, I have to see, does that fit into my scheme of things? If I can somehow rationally justify it, then perhaps yes. If not, I believe it's an excessive indulgence. And believe me, I think I enjoy the world as much as anyone else. But I have found a direction for myself. And in that way, avoid fragmentation. You know, even in terms of information overload, something that we really have to be cautious about. And let me share with you a bit of wisdom that came from a rather unlikely source, from a Conan Doyle, Sherlock Holmes. If you remember, there's one conversation that Watson has with Sherlock Holmes, where he tells Sherlock Holmes about the Copernican theory, right? That the Earth is not the center of the universe, but that the sun is the center of the solar system, the Earth turns around the sun. And Watson is shocked to discover that Sherlock Holmes was ignorant of the Copernican theory. And Holmes says to him, not only did I not know it, but now that you told me about it, I'll do my best to forget it. And Holmes is, you know, Watson is taken back. Forget it? Why would you want to forget it? He says, of what use is it to me? He says, my conceptualization of the human mind is that it is made of so many compartments, and you can put information into each compartment. But once it's reached its maximum, you cannot put any additional information there unless you take something out. He says, now, for my purpose in life, the things that I have to do, this bit of information is totally useless. Because for me, it makes little difference whether the moon goes around the earth or the earth goes around the moon or both. Right? Therefore, he says, I have no use for that information. Now, seems to be a very simple formula, but it's not completely without merit. And when I sit down and click on the internet and have 50 billion things available to me, right, I have to make a choice as to what is really important to me and only allow that bit of information in. And I think that if we want to avoid fragmentation from overload and fragmentation from being pulled in 50 different directions by 50 different people who want us to be 50 different things, that we have to become an I, a unit for ourselves, a unit of body and soul that was put here by Almighty for a specific purpose. And then it is for us to search what is that specific purpose for which I think I was created. And once we decide that, now how do I go fulfilling it? What contributes to that purpose and what doesn't? Anything that is extraneous to that purpose should be dismissed. Now, of course, since we are capable of deceiving ourselves, and what is there to stop me from saying, well, what I really need for my well-being is to watch the entire Steeler game from kickoff to end, which would mean 3 hours. What is there to say, what I really need for my emotional well-being is to spend 6 months of a year on vacation, if that were possible. How can we avoid indulgence and yet rationalize that this is what we really need? And the answer is that you can't. And this is where the Talmud was so wise in saying, Aseh lecharav, make for yourself a teacher, make for yourself a guide. If we leave it to our own intelligence, we are so capable of deceiving ourselves. I certainly am in the business of watching the world's greatest experts on rationalization, because you've never heard rationalization until you've talked with an alcoholic. I had one gentleman who was an alcoholic for over 20 years, and he once told me, he says, you know, doctor, I never once in my entire life ever took a drink unless I decided it was the right thing to do at the time. So you see, it's so easy to rationalize, and everything can become the right thing. Unless we have someone check it out for us, is this the right thing or isn't it? And so we should have guides. And this is one of the most wonderful things I found in the recovery program, that everybody is required to have a sponsor. And if you want to recover, have a sponsor and check out what you're going to do with someone else instead of relying on your own intelligence, because our own intelligence is so often colored and driven by the kinds of things that we want to do rather than the kinds of things that we should do. So yes, there can be a wholesomeness. But before we can get to that wholesomeness, we have to have an I. And I think that we ought to ask ourselves that question. Just who am I and what am I for? See, to have a sense of value, you really have to answer the question, what am I for? And if you wonder why is that, I suggest we'll go home tonight and look at your house and see what things you have there that are of value and why they are of value to you. And you'll find out that you come up with only two possibilities. Any item that you have in your house that you value is either because it serves a function or because it has aesthetic value. It's attractive and it has no function, but it's beautiful. So no, a picture does not have any function, but it is attractive. Now, I happen to have a grandfather clock. The mechanism hasn't worked for years, but I still keep it because it is a very attractive piece of furniture. I don't need it to tell time. It has an aesthetic value. So if it no longer works, it has an ornamental value. On the other hand, what do you do if your can opener stops working? Well, you're not going to hang it up by a string and display it from the ceiling. Right? It has lost its functional value, and since it has no aesthetic value, it's thrown into the trash can. And now I must ask, and what gives me value? Aesthetics? Ornamental? There are probably a few people that are blessed enough to consider themselves ornamental, decorative. Not everyone has that good fortune. I cannot look at the mirror and say I'm in aesthetic quality. So my value has to come out of function. Well, what is my function? Because if I cannot answer that question, then how can I say I have value? So see, there are these questions that we have to ask ourselves, and if I can't give you the answers tonight, I can tell you that if you will ask the questions and begin to think about them, you'll find the answers. And once you find the answer as to what it is that you're supposed to do, your life can become unidirectional. and once your life becomes unidirectional, then you're not fragmented, not by the information overload, because you dismiss that information that is not germane to your purpose in life. And you will not be pulled in many directions by different people who all want you to be different things, because you've already decided what it is you're going to be. And other people will have to adjust to that. So you see, there is a way of becoming wholesome in a world that is so terribly fragmented. But unless we do that, then we share the fragmentation of the world, and a fragmented self is the most unhappy self that we can be. So in order to achieve the kind of happiness, you notice I didn't say pleasure or contentment, but happiness, because happiness and contentment are not the same. A person cannot be content if he is in distress, but strangely enough, a person can be happy even while they are in distress. And if you have any question about that, just go into the labor rooms, right? And you'll find out that a mother in labor may be suffering, but she can be very happy. Right? When the suffering is for a purpose, right, a person can be happy. Not content, but happy. So if we ask the right questions, and we do some thinking, and get some guidelines, we can come up with the right answers. I'm not going to commercialize here on the value of the yeshiva. But remember that the yeshiva represents thousands of years of wisdom, of heritage that has come down. Does everyone adopt it? It doesn't bother me if everyone doesn't adopt it. What bothers me is that sometimes we neglect to look into it. Here we have a fount of wisdom that is unequaled anywhere in the world, and it's ours. And so much of what the world shares has had its origin with us. And yet, those of us who are the original owners of it sometimes allow ourselves to be ignorant of it. So that we have to maximize our studies and take advantage of the scholars who are available in the yeshivas. Take advantage of the books, of the tapes on Torah, and to be able to glean from the wisdom of centuries what they have to say about a direction in our lives. And I can't promise everyone contentment, but a pursuit of happiness is what we can get. And don't forget, it never said in the Declaration of Independence that our inalienable rights are pleasure or happiness. It says the pursuit of happiness. If we ask the right questions, look for the right answers, then we can pursue the happiness. And strangely enough, if we pursue it the right way, it can be ours. Thank you.